This is How I Got Here, a podcast where we interview professionals about how they navigated the twists and turns of their careers. We hope these conversations can help you figure out where you want to go and how you'll get there.
We're your hosts. I'm Lara Mitra.
And I'm Eric Eliason.
In each episode, we'll first give you a quick intro about who we are speaking with, and then we'll dive into the interview. To stay up to date, follow How I Got Here on LinkedIn and subscribe to our newsletter at howigotherepodcast.com. We hope you enjoy.
To kick off season 3 of How I Got Here, I'm extremely excited to share our interview with Katie Burke, Chief People Officer at HubSpot. Our conversation was wide-scoped, and Katie is extremely thoughtful and articulate about the decisions she's made and the challenges she's faced. One of the things that has stuck with me in the weeks after this conversation was Katie's ability to navigate her career along two seemingly opposed career truths. First is that you know yourself best, and second, that you have limited knowledge based on your own experiences, so it's important to be open-minded and not overly rigid about where you want to go. The way Katie threads the needle here is by being firm on her values, but open on the destination. Rather than taking the approach many of us take, which is to pick some role and work backwards to see how we can get there, Katie leads with her values and what drives her and lets her career guide her to whatever next makes sense. Listen on to hear how Katie went from never having heard of business school and thinking she was destined to be a lawyer to where she is today.
Hi, I'm Katie Burke. I'm the Chief People Officer at HubSpot, a CRM company based in Boston.
We'd love to hear just a little bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up? Did you have particular hobbies or things you were passionate about?
Yeah, so I was born in Boston, which is funny because I'm back here now, but I was super duper lucky. So I'm the oldest in my family. I'm now the oldest of 6 kids. I think kind of who I am as a person at my core is being a bossy older sister. That's kind of like my ethos as a person. We were lucky enough to move to Vancouver when I was 6. So I grew up part of my childhood in Vancouver, then Connecticut, then moved back here halfway through high school. Then went to college at Bates in Maine, then moved to DC, then New York, then back here. And so on paper, it kind of looks like I've been like born and bred in Boston. and really my experience has been a bit more different. And so one of the things I always say to people is I've had the experience of being a new kid a fair amount. And it's part of where my passion for inclusion and belonging comes from, because I know what it's like to sit there on the first day and not know anyone.
Could you talk a little bit more about what that was like and how that may have influenced you and how it plays out today in your work?
Absolutely. So when I moved to Vancouver, I was in grade 1, as they call it in Canada, and got there and was at a brand new school. And one of the coolest things about living in Vancouver, as you too well know, is Vancouver is a very multicultural city. And so most of the people in my class had been born in other countries, or their parents had been born in other countries and emigrated to Canada. And so I remember opening my lunch, I had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And I remember being like, I'm the only kid without seaweed in my lunch. That's so different and unique. And so I think it gave me kind of 2 gifts. One is curiosity. So when something is different, I'm usually interested in dig in versus kind of judging it. And 2 is a little bit of confidence. I think you have to be the person who walks into a room and says, hi, you know, I'm Katie. I'd love to meet you and tell me about yourself. And I think that's a good thing, because ultimately when you're running HR and recruiting for a big org, you've got to connect and build connections with people quickly. And then the final thing I think it gave me is a little bit of empathy for the fact that it's just really hard and sometimes really awkward and lonely to walk in a room when you don't know people.
You also mentioned you moved around a lot during your, you know, early childhood. What drove all of those moves?
Yeah, so my dad worked in hockey. My dad, so interesting, my mom put my dad through law school. So my mom was like the real OG back in the day. And my dad went to law school, and when he graduated, wanted to land a job in sports. And the person who gave him his first break was a man called Pat Quinn, who is hugely influential in our family. And so we up and moved to Vancouver for my dad's job and role, and then moved back to Connecticut for a job he took with the Whalers. Then he was working in New York for the NHL. And so one of the things about being a sports kid is you obviously go where there's very few jobs. And so you go where those jobs and roles are. And so our family has been lucky to support teams and to have my dad live in multiple different geos and countries. But it's been a cool way to see and understand the world.
And did you have a sense when you were growing up of what you wanted to be later on in life in terms of your career and profession?
I did want to be a lawyer and knew that pretty early on and kind of told people that. And so, you know, if you met me when I was 10, I think I would have told you, like, I want to be a lawyer in some way, shape or form. And we'll get to it later. But that did not work out for me. And so I think actually it's a good example of sometimes misplaced confidence in what you want to be is overrated.
Well, makes sense. And we know that when you went to college, you studied in American studies. And I'm wondering, was that part of this plan of being a lawyer, or what drew you to that major, if not?
I think what really drew me to American studies is it's the ultimate way not to actually decide on a major, really. It's avoidance is what it is. But I really do think the reason that I picked it and gravitated toward it was because it's so all-encompassing. So I got to take courses, which I still think are so valuable to this day, on gender studies, on African-American studies. I took rhetoric courses that are incredibly valuable to communications now. And so what I loved about it was so interdisciplinary that it allowed me to glean so many things from different subjects. And the other reason that I picked it candidly was I got certified to teach 7th through 12th grade. So I got my teaching certification. So I'm technically a certified middle school teacher. And that was a really formative experience.
And during this period, did you ever consider, you know, changing your course of path and dropping the whole law school thing, becoming a lawyer and going into teaching?
I have always thought of teaching as something that I would want to come back to. I still think of it to this day. I really enjoy it. I knew even at the time that I didn't think I wanted to be in the classroom every single day. But what I did want to do, my hero from when I was, I think, 7, was Marion Wright Edelman, who was the founder of the National Children's Defense Fund. And the reason that I loved her and admired her so much and still do to this day was she combined the law and policy with a real kind of sense of social justice and wanting to change the world. And so in my head, I was like, great, I'll get certified to teach. I'll have the education kind of discipline and experience. I worked in college at the Department of Education, did a bunch of work on their diversity and inclusion initiatives there. And then my goal was, great, go to law school, then I'll get the policy and law side of things, and then it'll be great. Maybe I'll work at National Children's Defense Fund. Maybe I'll work in a policy kind of capacity and see what I want to do. And then, of course, that didn't work out. So I took a different path. But to me, it was always teaching was always something that I wanted to, a skill I wanted to have and get better at, that I think is still useful to me to this day. And I would still be lucky and honored to teach at any level at some point in my career later.
So how did you go about thinking about what should my first job after graduation, what should that be?
So while I was at Bates, I was your classic, did the checklist of everything, quote unquote, right. I got great grades. I played sports. I was a volunteer. I was a student teacher. I checked off everything, almost to the expense of having a lot of fun in college. I was so focused on getting into law school and doing the right thing and being the best student that I think I missed, honestly, some opportunities that I would have really enjoyed. And the joke was on me when my senior year, I bombed the LSAT, didn't get into law school. And you can imagine it kind of felt like everything I had worked for came to a screeching halt. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, when you say that now, reflecting on when you're 22, it feels silly because, of course, if anything, it was such a catalyst for so many good things in my life. But I always share that with people because I think sometimes people share their biggest career weaknesses. Okay, my biggest weakness is I work too hard. And my biggest weakness and career failure started right out of the gate. Like, to say that I failed out of the gate is an understatement. I felt embarrassed. I had told everyone from first grade on that I wanted to be a lawyer. And so I kind of was like, who am I if I'm not this goal that I said I wanted to achieve? And what will people think of me? And turns out no one cares that much or thinks that much about you. Like, don't flatter yourself a little bit is the lesson there. Yeah. And then I think the second lesson is really that you always have to have a different plan from the vision you set out for yourself. And that's true both in failure and in success. So I would say in not getting into law school, I learned a lot about setting goals, about accepting failure, about pivoting. But I would also say at HubSpot, I've been lucky enough to have a ton of great success, and that unto itself has included some pivots that have been meaningful. And so I think having one destination that you are so wed to is often a mistake. And oftentimes you miss interesting destinations on the way.
That sounds like such a, in hindsight, maybe a little bit, it's like, wow, it was like a positive thing. But when you're 22 and this is the plan, how did you think about, I'm going to take the LSAT again and I'm not going to give up this dream? Or did you say, all right, it's time to move on? Like, I'm wondering how you navigated deciding to move on to the next thing.
I think I was so floored and shocked that I didn't know what to do. And so I'm kind of been in the, you know, Finding Nemo, just keep swimming mode. Always. I'm pretty much like, okay, if I don't know what to do, I keep moving. Mm-hmm. And so I think I just kept moving and things kind of fell into place from there. I think at that point I knew I couldn't go to law school that fall. And so I knew I needed an immediate plan. So the problem was actually the next year. What the heck am I going to do the next year? And so one good thing was I knew I wanted to live in Washington, D.C. I had spent a bunch of time there when I was in college. I knew for sure that I wanted to be back there, but I didn't have a job. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And so basically what I did was I networked around from people I had been in touch with last summer. I got a job and it was actually a really interesting job. I ended up going there and doing a bunch of work on Homeland Security. One of my jobs was running scenario planning exercises. So we would run tabletop exercises where you would simulate a natural disaster or a terrorist attack and watch how different agencies engaged and react. Mm-hmm. But I knew for sure right from the start, this wasn't my long-term play. And I was actually at one of those exercises in Denver, and I was in the Denver airport when I got a call about a job at a company called the Glover Park Group. And they were a startup in the kind of crisis communications, political consulting world. And that was not a world that I thought I was going to pursue. It wasn't something I had ever considered. And I interviewed for that job and role. And honestly, it was one of the best and most formative experiences of my career to end up there. And so it all worked out.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your experience at Glover Park Group and why it was so formative? What did you learn about yourself in terms of what you valued in a role and in your job versus maybe what you didn't?
Yeah, Glover Park was such an interesting group of people. And so I didn't know what a startup was. I definitely didn't know what a political communications firm was. I think the lessons for me from Glover Park were, number one, that you can really love your job. I kind of didn't know. I kind of thought you could like your job. I didn't know you could love it. And I genuinely love the people I worked with. It was so fun. It was so energizing. It was so exciting. And I'm still friends with many of those people to this day. The second lesson was that I loved adrenaline. I still love adrenaline at work. And so one of the things about GPG was oftentimes you'd get a call on a Friday night. A client has a tough situation. The way I describe it is we all wanted to be Olivia Pope before we knew Olivia Pope existed. And so you'd get these calls on Friday night. You need to put together a pitch and a proposal and you need to write copy really quickly. And it was such a great training ground mm-hmm. for the work I do now and for just generally working in tech, because when you've worked in crisis communications, almost everything else feels like slow motion. And so the kind of affinity for adrenaline and for a fast-paced work environment, I didn't know how important that was to me until I had it. And I really, really loved it. And then the third thing I think I learned there was just how much I really loved the work of communication. So I think I always liked writing. I always loved kind of the marketing world side of things, but I didn't think I would ever do it as a career. And at Glover Park, because we were such a small team, you got firsthand experience writing radio ads and writing op-eds and having to do them quickly. And that's a skill that frankly still benefits me to this day. And so I felt lucky to get kind of a firsthand training ground at GPG doing that work.
And is this the point in your career where you were like reflecting and thinking, wow, it's actually, you know, not a terrible thing that law school didn't work out. It's actually a blessing in disguise because I found this new passion, or did that transition not happen yet?
I don't think it happened yet. I think at the time I still felt a little, the sting of failure still stung a little bit. And I also still felt like, okay, but do I know I want to be, a partner at GPG eventually? Do I know I want to do this forever? And I kind of felt like I didn't know that. And so I actually think that's part of that not knowing is part of what drove moving to New York City. Because I think for me, so I moved to New York with Glover Park. So it was kind of like, okay, let me mix it up, but still within the same company and see what else is out there. And that was a wonderful experience. But I don't think I knew for sure that the law school thing was a blessing in disguise until I got into business school.
Katie, it sounds like law school or being a lawyer was such a big part of your identity before, you know, as you were aspiring towards it. I'm wondering, was part of that also influenced by your dad? Because I know he was a lawyer.
Yes, I think it's such an important question. I think my biggest takeaway for people listening to your podcast is the possibilities that exist for career growth are infinite. But all you know when you're growing up is what's in front of you or what's taught to you in books or by your own parents or family. And so if I had bothered at the time to do any sort of research around what lawyers actually do every day, they mark up documents, they need to be incredibly detail-oriented, they need to be great at contracts and logistics, that sort of thing. I'm not actually good at any of those things. And the truth is the LSAT was a great barometer of that logical, rigid thinking of if this and that is not how I think. It truly is not how my brain works. My brother is now a lawyer and it is literally how his brain works. It's not how I'm wired. And so I think it's a great example of, yeah, I was very attached to it because it was something that I knew from my home, but also from other people in my family or people that I admired. And it led me to anchor to a goal that actually just wasn't right. Even if I had gotten into law school, I don't think I would have been a great lawyer. I really don't believe that. And so I think it's a great example. One of the things I'm really passionate about with my youngest sisters is getting them exposed to careers they didn't even know existed. So a good example is UX researchers and designers. And like you basically think of working in tech as an engineer or as someone in sales. Well, there's a million other jobs within a company that you don't even know exist. And so one thing I'm passionate about is I do think more people growing up should know that lawyer, doctor, you know, like those are not the only journalist, those are not the only professions available to you. And it's worth kicking the tires to understand what other options exist that combine things you're passionate about.
What do you think is the best way for a young person to get that sort of perspective when they are oftentimes like in this bubble?
Things like this podcast, just listening and going, wait a second, this person was this role. What is a copywriter? What does that actually mean? Being curious and kind of taking notes of those things. So rather than, for example, even in this conversation, gravitating towards, okay, this person didn't get into law school. That's something I know. Instead going, okay, what do Eric, Lara, Katie, what are the jobs on their resumes that I had never heard of before? Yeah. And doing a little bit of digging and research to find someone who is that, or looking up your at your high school or college, your alumni network for jobs that you don't know or have heard of. And I think oftentimes those people are the least inundated with questions about their career and often have the most interesting paths. And then the other thing I would just say is if you read up on people that you admire, oftentimes they have junctures in their career that are counterintuitive. And I think just paying attention to what they were doing, what their titles were during that time, and researching those types of things make a big difference.
Katie, the other half of that equation is self-knowledge and figuring out what you like so you know what you're looking for. And it sounds like you had a really great experience, you know, in your first kind of job there out of college to understand here are the couple of things that I care about. And so I'm wondering, what drew you to end up going to business school and applying to business school? Did you have a kind of a path of what you were trying to head towards at that point?
I would love to say that I did, but I didn't. So one of the best gifts of my life was when I moved to New York, I didn't know anyone. And I was lucky enough to meet a few women in the first week who then we formed a book club. And the book club became kind of the center of my social universe in New York. And there are women who are still friends of mine to this day. But at the time, there were three women in the book club who were considering business school. I had never heard of business school before. I didn't know what it was. I certainly had no intention of going, but as I started to hear about why they were interested in business school, all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, okay, interesting. So it's creative thinking, it's operational excellence, it's strategy. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, you get to learn and debate really important leadership decisions. Like, that sounds actually kind of interesting to me. And so I would not have ended up applying to business school if it weren't for the influence of book club. And luckily, as I started learning more about it, the more research I did, the more it sounded appealing to me for what I wanted to do long term. And at the time, I was considering moving from politics into sports, and business school was a great way to consider that transition. And Sloan had the Sports Analytics Conference, which of course now is world famous, but at the time was a budding startup. And so I gravitated pretty early on to Sloan as the place where I could most easily and readily make that transition.
What was your time at Sloan like? You mentioned the Sports Analytics Conference, and what other sorts of things were you into?
I think I always am honest about my business school experience because I think everyone thinks most people have the same experience. So for example, I had a lot of classmates who traveled the world for whom their 2 years of business school was the best experience of their lives. I had an incredible experience at Sloan, but I was optimizing for different variables. So because I wanted to work in sports, many jobs in sports don't pay like consulting or finance jobs do. And so I pretty early on was optimizing for two things: landing in sports and then minimizing my debt leaving Sloan. And so I worked really hand. I mean, I was very involved in the sports conference. I interned at the New England Patriots. I was really singularly focused on kind of getting a job in sports. And while working on the sports conference is super helpful, obviously there aren't a lot of courses in sports business at MIT, so it meant you needed to hustle outside of school to focus on that.
Kitty, I really admire your dedication to pursuing what you wanted to get out of business school, because having just been in business school, I can tell you it's the biggest FOMO generator, I think, out there. Yes. I'm wondering, how did you navigate that? And it's such a great life lesson, not just business school, but in life, of pursuing what you care about, not what others care about. And I'm wondering, how did you handle that and redoubled your efforts to do what you wanted rather than getting drawn into other things?
Before I started at Sloan, I wrote down in a notebook, what are you hoping to get out of these 2 years? And it was number one, land a job in sports. It was number two, reduce your debt. And number three, make the most of the academic experience. So really invest. You're not going to miss class. You're going to be there. You're going to be a present student, and you're going to really be here for the next 2 years. And I actually think the act of writing down what you want really makes a difference. So I still do a vision board every year because it keeps me connected to the values that I care about the most. Like you, Eric, I think it can be super easy. So for example, the first week people are signing up for clubs and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I like all these clubs. This sounds interesting. You kind of get distracted. And you look back in your notebook and you just think to yourself, no, it's not why I'm here. So you can still attend and support and help other people out and be a great advocate for Lara, for the club that she's in, but you don't have to be in all these clubs to succeed. And I also think candidly, it was a learning from my undergrad experience where I tried to do everything and ended up not with the outcomes I wanted. And so I was much more values driven and focused. And I was much more clear on what I wanted from the experience versus what everyone else wanted.
And is there, and just one follow on, I think that's really, really helpful advice and just having time to reflect and to create a vision. And, but also what I see with your career is an openness to things that you didn't realize that were there. And so I'm wondering, how do you balance that of being rigid and following what you want, but also then saying, but I should be open to other things. I didn't even know what business school was. Like, I don't know. I don't know if you found that tension at all.
I think it's a good push. The way that I think about it is you have to be incredibly connected to your values and what drives you. And that should be clear and non-negotiable. And then incredibly open to opportunities that stretch you, that push you, that continue to grow. And so what I would say is even through that whole experience of learning and growing and taking a different career path, I would say people were pretty clear on what I wanted and what I cared about. So for example, still to this day, I care about doing meaningful work. I don't like wasting time. It is my absolute pet peeve to waste time almost to a fault. I really care about working with colleagues I admire. I want to learn from people. I want to be pushed by people. That value of a team is really important to me. And then three, I really want to move fast. I am not the person. If you wanted someone to sit there and kind of hang out and take things easily, and I just don't know how I would operate in that environment. And so I think knowing those three things is actually incredibly helpful, because it makes it so much easier to optimize for other decisions you're making. So for example, this year I joined the board at Paycor. When I was making that decision, I wasn't planning on it. I wasn't interviewing you for it. I didn't put myself out there. You make the decision against your values. Okay, do I care about the opportunity and the space? Am I passionate about it? Do I love the team? And oh, by the way, is it fast paced? And is it going to interest me and teach me something? It is much easier to be open on your destination if you're clear on what drives you and what anchors you and makes you happy.
And in your vision board, is that focused on the value side, or is that on the opportunities and like dreaming about what the future could hold?
It's both. So the vision board, what I like about it is I always do it on I think it's an 8x10, but basically there's a forcing function of this size. So what I like about it is, you know, it's the size of a relatively large picture frame, and distilling what you want in a year down to something that fits in an 8x10 picture frame is really hard, and it makes you conscious of what you put in that space. And so I combine things I want to achieve in a given year with how I want to feel and what I want to do in that year. So a good example on that front is a few years ago, it's funny, your vision board, no one else really sees except you. But a few years ago when I was working at HubSpot, I wasn't sure if I wanted to put VP on there because it kind of felt like audacious, right? To put a title on there. I was kind of like, I'm not sure, but I really wanted it. It was important to me. And that was a goal, a stretch goal for me. And so at one point I put VP on there. I've put other kind of career milestones on there for me, but oftentimes it also shows a picture. Like one of my pictures for this year shows a girls trip, and it literally shows girls in the back of a car cracking up laughing. And that's for time with my friends. And so you'll see quite serious milestones that I care about, but you'll also see things I want to do and experience. And what I like about it is I'm not a big resolutions person. I think they mostly fail. What I like about the vision board is it's not a one-time thing. It's kind of a commitment for a year on what you care about and what you're going to prioritize. And it comes back to, again, then if someone asks me to do something, does it fit on my vision for that year? And if not, it's much easier to say no, because I'm really clear and intentional. I've spent the time on what I want to do and be and how I want to spend my energy in a given year.
So shifting back to your career path, you are about to graduate Sloan and you're thinking about your next opportunities. How are you thinking about what comes next?
I graduated from Sloan in a massive economic downturn. So probably the worst timing ever. When my second year was when Lehman collapsed, when you know, the markets were just a complete mess. And so it was interesting. I was interning at a company called Athletes Performance, which is now rebranded to Exos. But at the time, Athletes Performance was an elite athlete training facility for mostly Major League Baseball, soccer players, a bunch of elite athletes at the time. Mia Hamm and Nomar Garciaparra were kind of our big marquee clients and customers. And we were building out a consumer brand to help bring that high performance model to the masses. And so you can imagine when the world went sideways, it threw our growth plans to grow kind of for a loop overall. And so I was fortunate enough that I was interning there. What I decided to do when the economy took a bit of a downturn between my first and second year was I stayed on working. So I didn't want them to be able to forget about me or not be able to make me an offer. And so I stayed on working through my whole second year, just interning and doing a bunch of marketing work for them on the side. And what that led to is me being able to get an offer in spite of the fact the economy wasn't as great as it might've been otherwise. And two, I think it just showed the value of being able to pivot. I wanted to work in sports. This is a great opportunity. I still care about and love this company. The growth and trajectory that we have may not be what I signed up for, but corporate wellness was a super interesting way to learn and grow. And honestly, now even at HubSpot, learning some of the ways in which CFOs and CHROs at the time thought about performance and wellness and healthcare costs is still informative to this day and still impacts my experience.
And I'm wondering, Katie, now a few years after you graduate Sloan, you've been at Exos for a few years. You then end up working and getting a job at HubSpot, which we know the story there. You've been there for quite a while. Can you share the story of why you pivoted to work at HubSpot? What drew you? Because your story up until this point, it sounds like it's sports adjacent, and then you're going to go work at this tech startup called HubSpot. Like, can you tell me a little bit more about why that was?
Yes. So I had a wonderful experience at Exos overall, but I was on a plane to Phoenix every single week. The lifestyle appeal that had been really exciting and energizing to me was just no longer real. It was, it just wasn't, I felt like I lived on a plane versus living here. And I didn't like that. And then the other thing I'll say is just the culture of the org had changed a little bit with growth and some decisions on kind of how the business grew. And I think one thing that can be hard for people to do is to break up with the illusion or commitment that they made to something publicly. So for me, it was first law school. Then I had told people I wanted to do politics and sports. And so now I was working in sports. To leave working in sports, you know, who would people think I was? And did it make sense? And could I ever get back? And I think it's just a good example of what you, sometimes the sexiest job is not the best job to make you happy. And I also think it's a good example of only you know what makes you happy on an everyday basis. So said differently, what I hear from people when they graduate from school is oftentimes they're like, I got a job as fill in the blank, and they watch people's reaction to it. And to me, you need to not watch other people's reactions to it. You need to watch your own internal reaction. Are you still genuinely excited to go to work every day? And so leaving to go to HubSpot was certainly not a conventional choice. It was certainly not something my family or friends saw coming. But for me, the reason I knew in my heart it was the right thing to do was I didn't want to live on a plane. I knew what my values were and what I wanted. And I also knew I could always go back to sports if I wanted to, because I had created that optionality by working so hard. And so I knew for me, my day-to-day experience was more important than how something looked from the outside.
And what's the story behind how you heard about HubSpot and got that role in the first place?
The story from HubSpot is actually a funny one. My classmate, Brad Coffey, who until recently was our chief strategy officer at HubSpot, he interned at HubSpot. He was the first MBA intern, and he would talk about HubSpot incessantly. And, you know, another thing about knowing what you're good at and what you're not, I'm not great at spotting early stage companies. It's kind of not, but I've never, a good example on this front to take early stage companies, spotting trends. I thought Twitter was a passing trend too. I'm not great at spotting things like that. And so when he would talk about HubSpot as a marketing company, I thought, you know, that's adorable that Brad's working there and so happy. Doesn't sound like, you know, a scale up to me. But I always really, all kidding aside, admired Brad. So he and I were strategy teammates along with a couple who was in our class, and he and I were good friends. And basically the four of us were working on strategy projects. And I remember thinking, this is what a team should be like. This is how things should operate. It was interesting. We were pushing each other. And so I always had the impression with Brad of he's someone that I want to work with because he cares about excellence. He's driven. He's thoughtful. He's analytical. And we, by the way, see the world completely opposite. So when we would see a problem in business school, he would open a pivot table to figure it out. And I would open a Word doc. Right? Like I think of everything as like, what are the incentives and what do people care about? And he would always open like, okay, how are we pricing this? And so I always knew I wanted to work with him at some point down the line. And so when I was thinking about a move, I called him, not with the intention of working at HubSpot, but just to kind of get his advice. And I went to visit him at HubSpot. And he was like, I don't think you should leave. I think you should take a job here. We should figure out what that is. And so the whole reason that I'm at HubSpot is because of my friendship with Brad.
That's amazing. And Katie, just to fast forward a little bit, we know you joined doing a lot of marketing work for HubSpot, and then you made this transition to something different. And I'm curious if you could help us understand, how did that transition come to happen, and what drove you to do that?
Yes. So I should say, I always take the job at HubSpot that no one else wanted. And so when I started, I worked in marketing. I was supposed to work in product marketing. I was a horrible product marketer. I'm still a horrible product marketer. But at the time, our CEO, Brian Halligan, had written a blog post that said why PR is dead. And the reason for that was we were an inbound marketing company and we were doing more blog posts, that sort of thing, and traditional PR, he felt, was dead. I felt he was wrong. And because of my work at Glover Park Group, I felt as though no one knew what HubSpot did. So if you were to walk around Boston, everyone knew HubSpot was a hot company. No one knew that we'd sold software. So a good example was early on, first 2 weeks at HubSpot, I was talking to one of my classmates from business school. They said, I had no idea you went to work for HubSpot. And they were talking about, they were like, what does HubSpot do? And then you start talking and they're like, oh, I just bought Eloqua, which is a rival software at the time. And they had no idea that we sold marketing software. Well, that's problematic for our business growth, but it's also really problematic for a potential IPO. Because if we want a valuation that's rooted in being a SaaS provider, guess what? People need to know you're a SaaS company. And so Brian has and had a tendency back in the day of walking through the kitchen. He would often ask people, especially Sloanies who worked at HubSpot, what they would do if they were in his seat. And I said, you need a PR strategy. And he said, what would that look like? And so I generated one. People thought I was crazy to take the job at the time. And turns out it led to being able to run internal and external communications for the IPO and set the stage for kind of our next stage of growth, which was super exciting. But to answer your question, the culture role specifically, one of the things we made a point to do at HubSpot was really do a lot of digging and work on what made companies successful after their IPO. So we were really, really clear. Our founders were really intentional from the start about saying that the IPO was a starting line, not a finish line for us. And so we interviewed a bunch of companies and we asked our bankers and lawyers. We didn't really care so much about the opening day. We cared about our success and our growth long after the IPO had happened. And in doing that digging and research and kind of talking to people, what we found was the biggest litmus test for companies' success has nothing to do with their product, very little to do with their marketing strategy, but everything to do with their team and culture. Because the reality is people will leave, things will change, your strategy will pivot. What you need is a remarkable culture and values that endure and a team that is remarkable at scale. And I was really struck during the IPO deck process of how many times we kept coming away from financials and coming back to our team and our culture code, which Dharmesh had authored. And so I knew how important it was to HubSpot's culture and to our success as a business overall. I didn't know that I was the person who could work on it. I had no illusions of that. And so literally 2 days after the IPO was when Dharmesh called me with that request and suggestion to take over the culture team and shepherd it. And at the time I said, no, it sounded like a great way to have a dead end career. And sure enough, I really respect Dharmesh and I respect Brian. I respect our former president, JD Sherman at the time. And the three of them all thought I should do it. And so my perspective on it was, why not try it for a year? The worst thing that could happen is I learn a bunch and try something different. And I can always go back to another role at HubSpot because I love it here. And sure enough, I loved it. The rest is history. But I think it's a good example of trusting the people you work with because they really did know something that I didn't at the time.
Yeah. And it sounds like it was very far from a dead end role because a few years later you were promoted to chief people officer of HubSpot, which is a huge deal. Could you tell us about getting that promotion and what it felt like?
I think it felt candidly like a huge honor, but a great responsibility. So I had crafted our first diversity and inclusion strategy, and I was so nervous presenting it to the board that I was physically shaking. And so then to a few years later, be HubSpot's first C-level executive, I was both really proud, first female C-level executive, I should say. I was really proud. I was also really terrified. And I don't think people talk enough about the fact that it wasn't just kind of a passing fear. I felt really deeply responsible to do well for existing female employees, but also for future female employees, for our female customers. Like I felt a lot of responsibility. And on one hand, that was really good. It really drove me to focus on excellence, to make sure I had a growth mindset, to make sure I was curious. On the other, I think I was so afraid of failing that I didn't take a deep breath for a few years and actually say like, it's all going to be fine. you are doing okay work. And so I was terrified. I was honored, but I was also terrified. And I think it's important to talk about that, because I think sometimes people think imposter syndrome stops when you get to a certain level or when you're at a certain company. And the truth is, it's in so many people, and it's there every time you take a leap or get a promotion. And I think more people should talk about it and embrace it, or talk about how they worked through it versus pretending it wasn't there or pretending it was just a blip on the radar. That anxiety wasn't with me for a week or a month. It was with me for 2 years until I actually could take a deep breath saying, I think this is going to work out okay. And it's good to be driven. It's good to be focused on excellence. But I think that weight and responsibility felt enormous at the time.
And how did you manage that, like in yourself, about feeling that anxiety and that weight?
Not well, I would say. I think one lesson I would have in general from my experience being CPO is that leaning into vulnerability is so critical, both for your success as a leader, but also for just your happiness as a human while you're navigating leadership. Because leadership, we talk about the CEO seat being lonely. Leadership in general is really lonely. I think a lot of people, managers feel lonely, or people, you know, anyone in leadership positions feel lonely. And so I think at the time I kind of viewed my job as to be as close to perfect as possible. And things really started to change about 2 years in, where I got a bunch of tough feedback about how hard I was working and how hard I was driving the team. And I think it really caused me to reflect on what kind of leader do you want to be long-term, and to be a bit more vulnerable, to lean into things I didn't know, and also to make sure that I was creating the type of lifestyle that I wanted that was sustainable for our team and org. So I think my tenure as CPO is a good example of something that looks like a huge success from the outside. And don't get me wrong, I'm really proud of what my team has achieved. But I think I failed a lot along the way. And I think the journey was harder than it might seem from the outside.
Kind of on that note, I love this. You're so vulnerable and honest with how, you know, what it looks like versus what it felt like in the moment. When you look back on your career and where you are and what you've accomplished, I'm wondering, how do you think about defining a successful career? And do you feel like you've achieved it yet, or are you still pursuing it?
I think both of those things. So I think I am still very much in pursuit of what I view as success in life and in work. And I will also say, I now have enough experience in my belt to know that if you're not celebrating those wins along the way, it's not fun for your team if they feel like they're not getting wins on the board. In your quest to become the best company culture in the world, you have to celebrate wins, milestones, little things, big things that help people along the way. And so I would say I am both still very hungry and eager to create more impact, and also incredibly proud of what our team has done.
You can check out more episodes and subscribe to our newsletter at howigotherepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.